This, in fact, is the first time, I believe, that I've tried to put two of these personalities together on the same day in the same place. It has become really impossible to keep them apart, and I'm not quite sure why the University of Warwick should be the place of their final wedding, as it were. Anyhow, they seem to be getting on reasonably well at the moment. I want to read some new poems and some poems which have already appeared in print. I think it's fair to say that what Mike was saying about my interest in history sometimes constitutes a bit of a barrier for readers of the poems because, well, people have different histories, and some of my poetry does draw on Irish historical allusions, sometimes on English historical allusions as well, which are not part of, say, an English poet's automatic vocabulary. So some of the poems may need a few notes. But I thought that for all our sakes, I'd start with some more, rather more personal and accessible poems. You'll notice the multitudinous copies. It's part of a tradition that one always brings a few copies to trade with. One of the peculiar byproducts of being somebody who writes within a very small culture like the Irish one is that everybody succeeds, as it were. There are no unsuccessful Irish poets, and we're all in the anthologies. One of the problems about being in the anthologies is that they always choose the same poem. So I'm going to start with my anthology poem. It's called Waking. It's in memory of my father, died November 1960. Someone is breathing in the room, apart from me. It is my father. I recognize the hiss of his nostrils, closing, closing. It is late. He is doing Milltown work. We can use the extra money. That stub in his hand is a rent book, high as a Bible, thin as his widow. Below it in the shadow I imagine the soft metal of his heart, a gold cog slipping, finally burred, refusing to bite. For my life I cannot picture him. Details melt into light, the angle of his nose, the slight furrow of moustache escape me. All I have is that sound fathered in darkness, carrying a reek of tobacco-y linen, the taste of his lip. He rustles like a curtain. Outside it is 6 a.m. A sudden fleet of cars passes, drowning my breath for about the length of a funeral. This has gone on 10 years. Well, I thought that was quite a sort of clean personal poem, nothing complex about its politics or its history or anything, and it duly made its entry into one of these anthologies. And one reviewer remarked on the high number of elegies for dead fathers and went on to elaborate a sort of cultural anthropology of the Irish artist as dispossessed, you know, always elegizing a dead father, who presumably is Shakespeare or somebody. Anyway, I think it's still quite simple. That is the last line indicates. That last line with the subtitle was written in 1970. This next poem is, in fact, I think probably the most recent one I've written, but also using that sense of childhood memory and so on. This is called Mount Argus, which is simply a large church and monastery outside Dublin, near where I was brought up. And in case anyone is nervous, there is a sardonic quotation from Wordsworth as we go. The grass rose in a mound to a crest of white flaming seed. The floss was white, And the truth is, even then, each shaking stem was white too. The mass of it looked green, or the shadow of each stem on the million like it became green without reflection. Branches of sycamore dipped and dipped in the summer heat. The blunt end of a mill house neatly appeared in the right corner. So it was to the growing boy, stirred by the plasma of water and rotten leaves trimming the field of his vision. Now, in the distant moment, it admits little of itself. The fear of what he once knew, the perfect, untouchable light. A little later on, I want to read some translations. Some from German, which have some right to be called translations, and one from Russian, which has none. I tried to translate a second poem from Russian and met my Waterloo. I am very interested in the Russian poet Joseph Brodsky, and with the assistance of a friend of mine, I wrote a version of his long elegy for John Donne. And I tried to write another version of a Brodsky poem and got nowhere. And I felt very frustrated about it, and several things came together, and I wrote this piece, which is called On Failing to Translate. It's really, I think, a love poem. The rain had stopped maybe an hour ago. We stood alone in the sodden garden, waiting to go home or be driven to some other furious hope. Exhaust fumes lay at the bottom of the road, grey upon grey, a carpet in a showroom. Then I heard, suddenly as if it had started to life, the rain still falling in the grass, dropping between the blades and the leaves, with a motion which I knew must startle us. And I said, "This is love's benediction and nothing more." The hands we held, shaking in farewell, were a bridge between us, pushing against either bank, a strength delicately equal to ours, but resisting always. The water beneath us bubbled downwards on its long journey back to the earth. I suppose, under pressure, I wouldn't really admit that there was a distinction between the sort of personal poems and the more historical ones. The two do meet very soon, I think. But there are, some of the poems are more accessible, I think, and I try to read a few of those first. This next poem is called Landscape with Minute Wildflowers, and you'll already probably have noticed that landscape seems to play quite a large part in what I write, and I think in what Irish writers do very frequently. Landscape is really a kind of substitute for, or if you like, a surrogate, a symbol of certain kinds of emotional state. This does have, I suppose, a certain kind of topographical position. It relates to the coast of North County Derry. There's a reference to Downhill, which is a little village, an estate, developed in the 18th century by a rather eccentric Anglican bishop, the Earl of Bristol, who was Bishop of Derry, one of the founders of Bristol, the Harveys of Bristol firm, to which we're all so indebted. And he was a radical political figure, quite a curious one. And the landscape of his estate is very dramatic, very strange, and somehow akin, I think, to his political problems of being a radical and a Protestant bishop in Ireland in the 18th century. So Downhill is a place name, and the Mussenden is a small neoclassical temple which he built on the edge of a cliff, looking out into the North Atlantic. It was said that he built it so that he could look across the bay to his parishes over in County Donegal, and with the aid of a telescope check whether the the clergy were in fact conducting their services at the right times and how the doors open in the churches. I'm sure that's not true. Again, there's a certain element, I think a level at which this is a love poem. The train moves stealthily along the shore, denying its rails between inseparable sand and stone. An invisible path leads under the cliff. Never was green so close to black, the waves pointless with motion, wind cranking itself through the sublime windows. Nature is perpetual, alas. Intent and purposeless, neither here nor there, the process returns to me. The wisp of diesel scaling the cliffs is a phrase of perfect execution. Everything is discreet, nearly. The open church door of 10-league parishes, clipped in the horizon, which beyond downhill is the straightest line in the world. Viewed from the Mussenden, the sea was marble in the making, distant coasts curved into focus, absorbed by liquid movements and the cold fury of the place. I stood high enough to see the deep pools designing themselves. Once when love seemed at an end and was not, I return lowly, blind, at work too. All the poems in the folder have been written since 1976. That last one was one of the last poems I think I wrote while living in Northern Ireland before I came to Leeds. This is another elegy, but it takes us in this rather hesitant or devious fashion that I'm adopting. It takes us close to the historical and the political. So an elegy for an Irish short story writer and novelist called Martin O'Kine, a Gaelic short story writer, that is, who was a Republican, a Marxist Republican, and when I knew him, a very old man. He'd taken up an academic post in his last years, but was never exactly integrated into university life. And the poem actually relates an incident fairly factually in the first stanza. This is one of a series of about 10-12 poems I wrote in something like sonnet form. It's a 14-line form, sort of self-imposed discipline which I was using at that time. The poem is called Risk, in memory of Martin O'Kine. When you chaired a meeting in Trinity, you refused to open until the man from the special branch had left the back row. You sat there reading while the audience hoped you weren't making a fool of yourself. At last, someone deserted out of loyalty. We never saw you as a widower, vainly stocking a life with whiskey, nor saw the massive verso timetables which you wrote those last stories on, nor heard your shy inquiries about drainage maps. The sheaves are stacked, your shade is lightening now. At the funeral, you scored a final point, refusing to hear a volley of shots. I'm afraid there's not very much in the way of humour to be found. I think I'll read some of the translations, which are far from humorous, but at least they again bring us teetering towards this historical and political material. I'd like to read principally translations from the German of Johannes Brabowski, the East German poet. A man with the most curious history and career. He was a conscript soldier in Hitler's army. He was captured by the Russians towards the end of the war. He spent a short period in a Russian prisoner of war camp. He was liberated, I think, in 1946. He came from an area which is now in Poland, pre-war East Prussia, where German and Polish was spoken, where there were also substantial Jewish and Gypsy elements in the population, an exceedingly mixed linguistic and cultural area. He was a Lutheran, a practicing Lutheran, certainly from midway on during the war, I think. And when he was liberated by the Russians, he opted to stay in East Germany, not to go to the West, on the grounds that it was only in East Germany that a proper purging of the German language could be effected. He felt, for reasons which I've never been able to work out, that the barbarism which had been committed on the German language as well as on humanity during the Nazi period, the German language was unable somehow to recover itself in the conditions of the Federal Republic. And, you know, you may have come across some quite interesting material recently on the way in which the two German languages are diverging. Anyhow, I was interested in Babowski for these reasons, his curious cultural mix and his preoccupation with language, and also his preoccupation with the past. The landscape of the poems is close to that of his birthplace, but populated sometimes by the Teutonic Knights, sometimes by invading Slavs, sometimes by Gypsies, wandering Jewish communities, and it's a sort of timeless world. And the poems have a very peculiar form. Some of them are rather like hymns, not so much in the German Lutheran sense as maybe something closer to the old Greek notion of hymn. And his sense of language, I think, was really what drew me to him, and so I wanted to try and translate a few of these. I'll read three, I think. The first is called To Be Named Always, and in it you encounter the sort of basic elements of Grabowski's landscape: stones, a bird, trees, a river, very little else beyond that. Very vestigial world. To be named always, the tree, the bird in flight, the reddish rock where the river pools green, and the fish in white smoke when it darkens down over the woods. Signs, colours. It is a game. I am thoughtful. It might not end aright. And who is to teach me what I forgot? The stones sleep, sleep of the birds in flight, the trees sleep. In the dark, does their utterance go on? Were a god there, and in flesh, and able to call me, I would walk about, I would wait a little. Again, in the end of this next poem, Lighting Back, there is also this preoccupation with a need to make some kind of purging statement about the German present or the immediate past, which will be intolerable, which no one will hear anyhow, he seems to suggest, no one will fully understand, and yet is obligatory. Twilight. How the grassland moves here, the wide current, plains, cold, untimely, the moon, a wingbeat now. On the banks of rivers, distant, when the broad sky held them embraced, we heard singing in the woodshade. The ancestor searched for overgrown ditches. Bird heart, light, feathered stone on the wind, falling into the mists, grass and the earth receive you for a death moment, a snail's track. But who is to bear me, man with closed eyes, evil-mouthed, hands that hold nothing, who follows the river, dying of thirst, who in the rains breathes the other age, which comes no more, other and unspoken, like clouds, a bird with open wings, raging against the sky, a counterlight, wild. And one last poem from the Hrabowski pieces called Memorial. In a way, I think it's the poem in which he comes closest to giving one, as it were, precise focus upon the war. At the end of the poem, you see him actually trying to work upon certain words in the German language and purify them, redeem them. The word, the original word which I translate as foreign, is precisely the word which the Nazis used against the Jews or the Gypsies as aliens, non-Aryans. And he's, as it were, trying to attribute the word now as something redeemed and honourable. Years, gossamer, the great spiders, years. The gypsies travelled the clay path with horses. The old gypsy chief came with the whip. The women stood in the gate yard, talking, in crooked arms, the handful of happiness. Later they were not seen. Then came the killers with leaden eyes. Once, the old woman above in the loft asked about the missing. Hear the rain streaming down the slope. They are moving, who no one else can see, on the old clay path, enveloped in spray, foreign crowns of wind over their black hair, lightly. What sort of time limit would you like to suggest, Mike?
Oh, I don't know.
Right. I'll read two poems which are called Diarist 1 and Diarist 2. Diarist is an unpronounceable word. I mean, people who write diaries. I became fascinated by the business of reading diaries. You have no idea, in a sense, if you read consecutive prose, what the relationship in time between one sentence and another is. But diaries actually go out of their way to tell you about intervening time, about the way in which one sentence does not know about the sentence which will follow. And I was reading a diary written by a countryman in the 1820s and 30s in the Irish countryside, a diary originally kept in Gaelic. And he decided to start his diary in mid-year, sometime around May. He decided he would start keeping a diary, and he kept it for many years. But he filled in the previous 5 months with little summaries of what those months had brought. And he plays on the etymology of the names of the months in Irish, so that, for example, April he describes as dripping, bleating, new, because of various traditional ways of explaining the names of the months and so on. So I wrote a poem which is partly a translation of those passages and partly an improvisation upon them. And I then felt very unhappy with this response. And so I wrote another poem, the second diarist poem, in which a very different perspective on one's experience, as it were, is taken. Anyhow, the first is this summary of the months which have passed. It was a
disturbed period in Ireland, as in England, of course. It's the period just leading up to the Great Reform Act, with a great deal of agrarian unrest, agrarian tension, rick burning and tithe confrontations and so on. January, fine frosty weather this month. Farmers putting out manure from headlands. At the Fuller's Mill I saw an otter fishing. Wet half the day now. Not a native tree green except the holly, some firs and the red laurel. The oats have failed that were broadcast at Michaelmas. Heavy rains, floods, a bog moving in Ulster owing to water under it. Cattle being swept away. Tense the sequence of months. All's blistered, rugate. April, dripping, bleating, new. Yellow-blue stalks broken in the field. Livid mouths swollen with hunger. 18 shillings a barrel for oats. Fierce fighting near Warsaw. The papers speak little of Callan's poor. 1,500 souls in anguish. The 26th day, St. Stephen's, a fine, thin-clouded, calm day with some sun. Soldiers and country boys scuffled on Thursday. A frosty, bright, sunny morning, ice on pools. Day's end, fresh cold, sharp. The beginning of night, moonlit, then covered with cloud. I live increasingly on paper. Patrick Doran jailed for his part against the soldiers. A heavy clouded morning. Day's end foggish. And I ultimately, as it were, reacted against the ability of the man to record his experience in this neat, objective way. So there follows the second poem. Aghast this morning, looking from the yard over the near mist and balmy granite of our new chapel, aghast to find the long continuity of hedge and ditch, endless and various means of maintaining the green rows which hold the fields together, the corners cut not a moment too soon, the gaps and gates swallowed in energy, though conscious with birdsong buried in growth, and then to turn to this empty ledger, the sloping desk and the worn initials of pre-emancipation, to find the gully of my nib dried up, or the inkpot burst with the night's frost. Is it bitterness or grace drives me to it, to an endeavour where perfection is at best avoided? The next poem is relatively long. It goes on for 4 pages, but the lines are very short. It's got a kind of complicated entrance. It's called Quinta del Sordo, which is the name of Goya's house. I was interested at that time in those paintings and drawings which Goya did of the war against Napoleon in Spain, and you know the famous one of the execution with the fat little Spanish peasant with his hands thrown up, the soldiers levelling their guns at him, and the eye of the viewers, as it were, running along the barrels of the guns. There's a great blocked huge lamp, artificially large, sort of false perspective, glowing orange lamp at the feet of the soldiers, casting light up onto this figure. A very savage portrait of a revolutionary or premature revolutionary war. And it merged in my mind with a story which is, in a way, difficult to relate, and in a sense I don't think is necessary to an understanding of the poem, but you might as well know it anyhow. During the 1930s, as indeed now, there was a violent internal conflict in the Irish Republican Army, and a man called Michael Devereux disappeared. He was a member of the IRA, disappeared in the winter of 1940-41. His body was never found. One of the curiously gruesome details of the case I always felt was that his body was never found, but his car was found dismembered and buried in different places around the whole county. It was like a kind of vicarious, vicious dismemberment. And another member of the IRA called George Plant, who, by one of those ironies with which we revel, was a Protestant, was arrested and charged with Devereux's murder. The case was heard. The Devereux's Plant's accomplices swore in court, probably quite truthfully, that their testimony had been extracted under duress. The case was thrown out. Plant was released. He was arrested on the doorstep of the court, tried by a military tribunal, and shot. And those two curious details came together. There was also perhaps some hint of that sort of childhood world that I was looking at in the earlier poems, in the way the poem opens. This didn't become my anthology poem. It was originally chosen for one of the anthologies. The editors, the publisher's editors, objected to a single word in it, and so we got to the elegy for my father instead. You should, I think, be able to spot the complaint. Maybe the complaint was a political one rather than a puritanical one. So it's called Quinto del Sordo, Deaf Man's House. In memory of Michael Devereux, disappeared in the winter of 1940-41, and George Plant, who died the 5th of March 1942. A flat light came over the sheds to spill down the galvanized roof when tar began to shine towards midday, and the roofs dipped in salute or levelled like our children's guns. This was the present then, a thatched house ironically renewed, dense yellow solidness boxed in between the house wall, open shed, and the diaphragm of the gate. The fields moved on several planes, a planetarium flexible, deluding, among raised ditches, a geometer's nightmare. As buttons of tar popped on the desolate roofs, the kitchen drew in its breath behind the dark window, and Grandfather Goya in the alcove shook his brush. There follows a brief sentence describing Devereux's body, the dismantled car concealed in dunghills through the county, and Plant's ultimate conviction on revoked evidence, Quinto del Sordo. There are no natural lines, only mass, reflection, and the energy of the eye. Through ribs of the alder, light heroically bared the sky. It was foolish, vacuous, touched with moments of subdued pity, disproportionate to the sight. So long ago, so still, the land lay like a great cunt, smiling with its usual poetic convenience, and several swallows had the goodness to make dummy runs at Earth's virtue. Nothing remains of virtue and atrocity. Fur and the nail's breath of man and the quadrumana, answering to the claw and hoof of other animals and birds, briefly flourish. The grave or cave is no one's, who bury purely in time. Nothing remains unmoved. The elements continually release the mind they fashion. Receding in contained lucidity, the tire tracks melt in spring's mud. The meadows obey, ignore us. Well, there is a joke in this one, actually, but it depends on my ability to tell it. You know the Bishop of Cloyne, Bishop Berkeley, you know, the man whom the theory of immaterialism, which Dr. Johnson refuted by kicking a stone. I was sitting in a public house in the town of Gort in County Galway, which is very near to the home of Lady Gregory, the headquarters, as it were, of the literary movement, based on the work of Yeats and Synge and Lady Gregory. And I overheard an extraordinary conversation between two farmers whose... I mean, they were talking about things like whether you should get your cattle injected or whether you bother buying the newspapers and so on. And it seemed to me that their sense of logic, their whole outlook on life was really a perfect vindication of Bishop Berkeley. It's important in a way to bear in mind that Cool, Lady Gregory's house, was not burnt, as many Irish great houses were, because, as it were, I deliberately get that wrong at the end of the poem. I was sitting on a high stool in Gort, watching the empty square between the streets. There is no square at the centre, just the abutment of four incomplete streets on nothing. A donkey and cart slumbered by the ruins of a rusting Morris Minor, the boot flourishing with dry grass. The animal was prone as wood, the creels tense with muscular exhaustion. Nothing moved near me in the renovated hall, though two farmers lounged on slender glasses half full of stout by the still piano. Then the fire siren broke into the square, slamming the door by the honeysuckle, a red invisible bull or other image. Like any traveller of bright modesty, I stood in respect. The donkey and cart rose and jockeyed towards one street, while noise circled with black pages of the queerest overhead. Fire siren filled the empty town of Gort, and no man moved from the shadow of doors, for the light still held its 50-year-old pot-still weak potency. Those who were about me did not falter. I had forgotten their deep arcana, forgotten, too, the burden of the donkey, the agony of his avocation. The engine in the chassis' loins dropped the depth of rust towards the ground. The speakers parted on a paradox, their tumblers lined with drying air. There's no use me reading the newspapers. There's only in them things that I don't know. In southern clawing over unapproved roads and air shining like a box of knives, Bishop's shade relaxed. Entirely I forgot the siren, firing Cool with my enthusiasm. I'm sorry that I gave the Galway farmers Sligo accents, but... I'll read one poem which I think is really very English indeed. In fact, I think it may well have some elements of parody and almost disrespect in it. As you probably know, the English department in Leeds, one of the professors there is Geoffrey Hill, one of, I suppose, the finest poets, English poets, since the generation of Eliot. And in a way which he would not, I think, greatly like, this poem has some bearing on that reputation. His car broke down once. That's really what happened to suggest the the poem. And it broke down near Towton, between Leeds and York. Towton, of course, the site of one of the dreadful massacres of the Wars of the Roses, and an incident, if indeed you can call that an incident, which Geoffrey Hill has used in his poetry. So it seemed a curious coincidence that his Volkswagen should break down there. I think it's also one of the few poems that I appear to be reading today which uses rhyme. It's called Winter's Tales, and again, as with the growing boy, there are a few concealed and, as I say, possibly disrespectful quotations, notably from the Shakespeare play whose title I get wrong. It comes in three sections. In declining dark, our fixed expression took the daily farm, the cattle's frozen stook from the urbane road. What epiphenomena of the closed observer glistered our code? with the same hour and differing light, the house darkened the land, blotted the skyline. At sutured Towton, we came on a car, its wheels splayed, only rescuable by abandon. And there snow lay too, the infinite verge, a white sheet bleaching on a hedge, or an abstract, long-forgotten statue of the fallen, of the plough-hacked. Now the house shone with ancient lights, though in slow approach the driver had gone from her immobile cell, and through the snow we met the fell droppings of an army. The sun fingers us, and the mild collapse of our cold continuum unwraps the heroine. With the springing earth as pedestal, the unfixed eye that pleases some tries all. How we have seen Hermione stretched on time, and feeding through quicklime the local fauna. And there's a short sequence of poems that I'm really very unhappy about. they're an attempt to deal much more directly with political barbarism than anything else I've done, and I'm not sure that I'm happy with them at all. So these are, as it were, given, possibly not by Maxton. Perhaps we'll attribute these to McCormack. they're called Songs from the Palatine, and they're pseudo-translations. The Palatines or Palatines, you know, are a group of Protestant immigrants who reached Britain, and particularly Ireland, and are perhaps in Ireland, anyhow, the only example of a religious group of immigrants being happily absorbed into the population. The Palatine is a figure in folklore and folk song, particularly, who is frequently cited as an example of communal harmony. There's a great Irish song called The Palatine's Daughter, which is perhaps the best-known example. So these are translations from the Palatine. As it were, I invent a language called Palatine, from which these are a translation. I think I'll only read, there are nine of them altogether. They're very short, but I'll just read a few. One of them is written in a Belfast accent. First is called Summary Execution. Marcos' death was not unnecessary, for it led to a truce with his last companions. Nevertheless, the papers omitted details of his rolled ears neatly stuffed in the nostrils. To be sure, the individual is expendable. V for victory, or for garden shears. The next one is in the Belfast accent. It actually is based again on a true story. The city councillors banned Emmanuel after the second private screening. A spokesman declared flatly, "Parts of it are definitely photographic." Standing in the black room, we were transfixed by her absence. In the madness of those coasts, men thought women lovely who were beautiful. The next is called Royalties, and takes one or two details from Herodotus's account of the Scythians. When his fourth queen committed suicide in London, he was already among the Scythians, soon to be immortalized on a diet of mare's milk. The great poet of the period wrote 15 creels of cubic terror, an order so complete as to defy, the argument so rounded, the phrasing so pointed, critics thought he had boxed the globe. 5. The cry of the whoremaster at dawn troops out. 6. After the second private screening, Fergus saw his dead child running towards him forever, smiling in her white noise. And the last one. When he fell before the firing squad, he was well disposed towards them. And lastly, I think I'd like to read the translation from Brodsky, or the version from Brodsky. it's much the Russian original is much longer, and our principal problem, I think, in trying to translate this was to find some fairly regular English form which would convey the weight, but also the energy of Brodsky's chosen meter. And what has happened, in fact, by a curious process that I don't understand, is that the the structure of this version is much more complex, I think. Well, that's pretentious to say that. It's certainly much more complicated, much more formally intricate than the Russian. When John Donne dropped to sleep, all around him slept. Pictures were drowsy on the wall, the floor was deep in rugs and tables, furniture, whose certain essence was a sleep that kept the clocks as motionless as lumber. At rest in cupboards as in dormitories, the linen slept as though it were bodies draped in animal slumber. Night was not idly here and there, turning the key or coiled in locks, but paused in heat, exhaling human shocks, to be at once impenetrable as air. All slept. The window in its envelope of snow might never have been written. The words it might have read remained unseen when John Donne unwakened and took his sleep. The iron weights in the butcher's shop are prone, in care of watchdogs shrunken from the chains. Mice are asleep and cats stiffen. The Thames nods its way towards a salted dawn, shaking the reflected tower and arch. Ships are anchorless by the wharf safely. The sea lies down beside a promontory, the land her bolster, intent and white as starch. The walls of the jail loosen in this rest, and prisoners lie still in their freedom, heedless of a momentary calm, before light draws its finger from the east. The angels also sleep above the globe, a world forgotten by the sleeping saints. In holy shame, fair paradise faints under the waves of the Lord's deepest robe. Gehenna sleeps, and man must fail to be. John Donne fails tonight, his last disaster. His breath and kiss and manly lines are lost. Satan sleeps, and with him all enmity. The prophets sleep. Good rests on evil's arm. The paling snow completes its last full stop as his stressed and wearied syllables drop in place to his drift of words' alarm. Everybody sleeps. The saints, devils, God, friends, deceitful servants, lovers in bed, lie dormant on this night John Donne is dead, and the snow shuffles its feet on the road. In the darkness of the white snow road, I hear a cry, I hear a frightened call, as if a man were left to carry all the bitter climate with his own painful load. He is weeping. Yes, somebody is there, his voice flaking at the brink of silence, like nervous hands, thin as a needle's eye and blind of thread. Somebody is near. Whose tears are these that I hear in darkness? An angel waiting in a cape of snow for rebirth of my last year's love below? O seraph, do I recognize your voice? I have often heard them in somber course. Have you absconded from my sleeping church to troop in silence under this dark birch? Or have your vain trumpetings made you hoarse? Then, Paul, this silence canvasses your name, the darkness surely being pure as glass. And yet your voice was distinctly harsh from straight talk, driving the pegs of Christ's claim. Or is our Father here, whose mighty hand has loomed over this place time out of mind? Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth. Oh, I find the impress of thy silence stuns the land. Was I alone to keep my open eyes, when guardsmen gathered in impassive gloom. Gabriel, announce your presence, whom I know to summon myriads in the skies. No, it is I, your soul, John Donne complains. Alone on heaven's pinnacle I weep, for things in my labor, even at its neap, has set afloat thoughts heavy as chains. You were aloft, and from the heights you saw a people whole. Despite your load, you could fly again through sin and passion to God, hell having seen, first as image, then raw. Seeing life, your island was its twin, and soaring past your lord, in pride fell content with burdens in the abysmal tide of the roaring ocean. From then, the lord seemed but a light that gleams, and all his radiant country was to you a fitful image moving to and fro, marsh fire, a creedal squint, or just a dream. His fields persist unbroken by a plough. The years lie fallow and the eras. Rain dances hugely in the formal grass. A perfect tense preserves your broken vow. But here I stand and weep. The road is gone. I cannot fly with my spirit's temple before death brings to me his ample deductions and certainty of tone. I languish in a passion of desire, stitching the last remnant of my spirit, the needle passing through my soul in merit of the empty snow so uselessly pure. But listen, while my weeping now disturbs your rest, the busy snow shuttles through the dark, unmelting but sewing up our hurt. Endlessly to and fro the needle works. It is not I who weep, but you, John Donne, who lies alone. Your poems in presses sleep, while snow assumes your house into the deep, and snow is drifting down from darkest heaven. All things are sunk in sleep. The final verse awaits its cue, baring its teeth to snarl, that earthly love is just a joker's role, and heavenly love becomes a friar's flesh. We find in life companions of such pith that life is shared and ground to common salt, but there's no lover under heaven's vault can intimate our soul and share our death. Man's coat is tattered, and it may be torn by all who want to tear it more. It frays and is redeemed to soar briefly the wearer's shroud. Once more it's worn. Sleep soundly done, and let your soul not mope in such dejected rags as darkness gives. The convex sky is glowing like a sieve, and holy stars invest your world with hope. I've realised, in fact, that there is one more poem. It occurred to me that, as I was reading that, some of the more recent poems have a more optimistic tone, nothing more than that. It's a matter of direction, I think, nothing else. So I'll just read one short poem called Beaumaris. You know, at Beaumaris in Anglesey, there is a wonderfully preserved castle, which is preserved because it was never completed. Because it was never completed, nobody ever attacked it. So there's a kind of Coleridgean logic to that somewhere, you know, that the sort of repletion of the fragment, that kind of thing. Tamarisk by Beaumaris. Water under the tower, calm and reflective. The tower ruined and complete. How it was, a king labouring beyond need in a subject land. The roots hold in the new soil. Facility in pink or blue lighten the air. The castle walls hold nothing but heat and guests. Separate muses parade on the ramparts. We have met there, above the clean door, and the restored wood replacing no wood. Content, that was your term, content. Across the channel, snow covered across, cut on the hillside, covered in snow. The north-looking hills, frozen but visible. The point on the circle where we pass the early winter, warm, ageless. Soon the moon bends a brown light over the salt marsh, the ashes of tamarisk. Night faces the king's route west. A millennium's waste of bronze and plastic litters the seabed. You lie beyond the terminal, brushed asleep by the restless, touching the moon with risen light. And that is the end.